Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this time we're going to be talking about a Nebula and Hugo finalist, which is Doorways in the Sand by Roger Zelazny, which was a finalist for both of those awards, like I said. And my guest for this episode is returning guest Bob Marl, who previously joined me for one of my early Zoomed Out episodes about pandemic fiction. So, hi, Bob. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. And I wanted to let everyone know how amazed I was at the editing job you did on that episode. I almost sounded coherent when you were done. So this time you may have to edit out some coughing and sniffling. I'm still getting over that cold that is sweeping the nation.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. So, Bob, you're a science fiction reader and writer with short story and novelette publications back in the 1900s, as we say. I remember talking about that last time, but it's been 2 years since we recorded the previous episode. So any updates?
Yes. Right after we recorded that episode, a novelette I had submitted to Asimov's got accepted. It was my first 21st century sale after coming back to writing after I retired. And since then, I've sold and published an analog as well. And I have a really fun story called Chuck's Gun out now in one of the newer online magazines called Trollbath.
Nice. So you went from no 21st century sales to three.
Thus far, I'm hoping to add a few more.
Excellent.
Thanks. So as you said, the book we're talking about today is Doorways in the Sand by Roger Zelazny. It was nominated for the Hugo and Nebula, but it lost in both awards to the same book, Forever War. I understood it at the time. It was right after Vietnam, and Forever War spoke to a lot of people, and me included. But I think the real reason Doorways in the Sand probably lost is that it's heavy on comedy. And the awards, I think, devalue comedy as an art form.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, no Hugos or Nebulas for Terry Pratchett or Douglas Adams.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just that some people take life and literature way too seriously, and they assume something that makes you laugh is beneath them. I'm sort of the opposite. To me, comedy is the highest art form. Mm.
It is interesting, though, that recently John Scalzi has been garnering Hugo finalist spots with books that are high on humor and pretty low on literature. But is humor the reason that you wanted to look at this book?
Mostly. I do like Zelazny, particularly Lord of Light.
Yeah.
And some of his short stories, and at least the first Amber book. To me, though, this book seems like a lost gem.
I see what you did there. It seems like a good segue into a bit of the non-spoiler plot synopsis for this one, for reasons that will become apparent.
Yeah. Okay, I'll start. This book is told in first person by one Fred Cassidy, a college student with a penchant for climbing buildings.
I thought that was interesting, sure. And it's the near future, or really retro future.
Yeah, right. There's flying cars, but no cell phones. Yeah.
They always miss wireless communication. But of course, there's also aliens from outer space.
Yeah, lots of them. The plot, it centers around an alien artifact called a star stone, an ancient, mysterious, gem-like artifact that's been lent to Earth as part of a cultural exchange, if you will. And when a supposed replica of the stone goes missing, all sorts of people and aliens are upset, and they all seem to think Fred knows something about it. And he dodges hoodlums, would-be helpful aliens in absurd animal costumes, and State Department officials, all the while receiving strange messages in his dreams or after he's been drinking. and I'll admit there are a few specific aspects of this book that made it a personal favorite when I first read it.
Ah, you get messages as well when you've had too much to drink?
I wish. The only message I ever get when I drink too much is that I've drunk too much. No, the thing I liked was when I read it, I was in college like Fred, not exactly like Fred, but close enough. And also, I occasionally climbed buildings. I did until a really scary incident convinced me that I should restrict my acrophilia to skydiving and hang gliding where the ground was far enough away you could do something about it.
Right.
Yeah, Fred Fred also, and this was probably the biggest thing, was that Fred was getting way more enjoyment out of his very extended undergraduate days than I was. So there was kind of an aspirational aspect. I wish I could do it like him.
Mm. I mean, I've definitely had times where I thought, you know what, going back to school could be fun. But I think really what I'm wanting to go back to is just being younger. Fred is like the eternal student. He's in his 13th year as an undergrad. Reminded me of the famous line from Better Off Dead, the John Cusack movie. Lane, I've been going to this high school for 7.5 years. I'm no dummy.
Yeah. In Fred's case, it's not that he's a bad student. He intentionally changes majors just to avoid graduating, because that way he can extend his mostly deceased uncle's bequest for his education. So among the people that he has to dodge is a college official that's trying to force him to graduate.
Yeah, yeah. And that's established pretty early in the book, the antagonism between the two. Although, it's probably not fair of me to picture him as William Atherton from Real Genius or Ghostbusters or Die Hard. You know, any 1980s dick in a movie was played by William Atherton. In this one, there's also kind of a detective mystery aspect.
Yeah.
But you don't really know what the crime is.
Yeah, which makes it kind of hard to figure out. But mm-hmm. Some things are obvious, but some are kind of buried deeper in the story. I normally do not like detective mystery subgenre mm-hmm. science fiction, but this was done in such a fun, kind of non-detective style, I didn't mind. The book really, though, came alive for me in the last line of chapter 3, when a wombat and a kangaroo rescue Fred from the desert.
As normally happens, the six-fingered aliens in animal suits with the kangaroo who extols the virtues of peanut butter as a source of protein.
Exactly. That was when I was hooked. And I just fell in love with the story and the absolutely absurdist prose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The writing is fun, and it's kind of trippy as well.
Yeah. The main character is often narrating from an altered mental state. He's either half asleep, dreaming, drunk, or recovering from various injuries that have been inflicted upon him. There is a lot of bewilderment and free association type thinking. You know, part of me wonders if this was a kind of reaction to the hyper-rational protagonists of the first superstars of science fiction, people like Clark and Asimov.
Mm. The book is dedicated to Asimov, actually.
Yeah, and it said, with affection. Maybe mm-hmm. maybe that was a preemptive apology for poking him a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the beginning of the book, the main thing going on with the character is confusion, and I definitely shared that confusion when I started reading it. I think I mentioned over email, like, I have no idea what's going on, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I actually think the confusion is intentional. You know, Zelazny seldom uses a straightforward narration. In this book, every chapter flashes forward in time.
You know? Yeah, yeah, like skipping ahead to a pivotal point in the chapter's narrative without any explanation, and then kind of walking it back to see how you got there. You know, I guess you're wondering how I got into this situation.
Yeah, exactly. Although a lot of times he just doesn't even tell you what's going on. It's just a big change.
No.
So you get the Latin term for this kind of narration is in media res. Right. And it's something very similar to what Zelazny did in Lord of Light, where he just mm-hmm. actually moved the chapters in and out of order. In the first Amber book, if you remember, he gave the main character amnesia and let the reader and the character figure it out what was going on together.
Okay. So, interesting. I actually have not read any of the Amber books. They're on my list for early next year, I think. So the character in the book, I think, probably figured things out faster than I did. I would say it's not a book that you can easily put down for a few days and come back to, because you're going to lose some of the thread of it. But fortunately, it's an easy enough read that I didn't really want to put it down.
Yeah, I actually kind of prefer a slow reveal. You know, all fiction starts with a reveal of, who the person is and whatnot. But in science fiction and fantasy, you have a lot more to explain. And, the quick and boring method to do is info dumps. But I enjoy kind of slowly piecing it together.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of info dump in the first couple chapters with the retiring professor kind of reminiscing.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's mainly about the main character and his education and the setting. But the reveal of the plot of the story comes much, much slower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, adding to the confusion of the flash forwards are that there's a lot of literary and scientific allusions that can be probably hard to puzzle out.
Yeah, the main character has been hopping from one college major to another, so he's absolutely filled with obscure knowledge, and he absolutely loves to use it.
Yeah, I kind of took it as a challenge because, you know, some of them you're going to get right away, and other ones are a little obscure, and you might want to go down a Wikipedia click hole on them. I actually have both an engineering and a liberal arts degree, so the interdisciplinary nature of his references worked for me.
Well, I was not as well armed in my first reading of it. I did. I had an incomplete biology degree. But, you know, and I know I missed a lot. But an example of this kind of flash forward, trippy writing and confused mental state, you can find it at the very beginning of chapter 3, which goes like this. Sun flash, some splash, darkle, star dance. Phaethon's solid gold Cadillac crashed where there was no ear to hear, lay burning, flickered, went out, like me. At least when I woke up again, it was night and I was a wreck.
Yeah, and that flashes way, way forward. Just kind of inexplicably taking Fred from campus to being delirious after the criminals had staked him out in the Australian desert.
Yeah, there's a lot to walk back there. But yeah. What got my attention was Phaethon, which I read to be a reference to the son of the Greek god Helios. Mm-hmm. Phaethon borrowed his dad's fiery sun chariot, but he didn't know how to control it and had to be knocked from the sky after he flew too close to the earth, burning it, and then too far away, freezing it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's a description of the burning desert day and the freezing desert night.
Exactly. And eventually Zeus strikes him out of the sky and he crashed where no ear could hear.
And lay burning, flickered, went out. His sunset.
Yeah. The whole book is filled with these. Now, some are obscure and there's no way you can get them all. The very start of the very next chapter, Fred is again inexplicably in orbit over the Earth, you know, but he's watching and he sees California and starts hoping that it might drop into the Pacific while he had a good look at it.
That's pretty dark.
Yeah. Well, California dropping into the Pacific was a really popular joke meme in the 1960s and 1970s because plate tectonics had just been invented and nobody understood it. Right. At any rate, Fred, musing from space, speculates how the event could provide, quote, some Donnelly of the future material for a book, end quote. You know I did not get that one on my first read, and I had to wait until the internet was invented so I could look it up. And what it refers to is Ignatius Donnelly, a pseudoscientist of the 1800s, who wrote this book about Atlantis dropping into the sea.
Yeah, talk about obscure.
Yeah. But it's not really tied to the narrative or plot. So it's kind of more of an Easter egg, if you will. And the book is filled with things like this. Some are one-off references. Some are narrative hints, like the Phaethon's chariot. But others, there are a lot of references to Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. And they're woven all through the story and plot.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the nature, like you mentioned before, of the character being in college for 13 years and constantly changing majors makes him the perfect narrator to be able to pull off that kind of thing.
Exactly. And it's also what makes the book really rereadable. As you get things a second and third time, you read them. Or in my case, someone invents Google so you can actually look it up.
Exactly. Yeah.
I did not get many of these till years later. And one we'll get to later that I didn't get until you pointed it out. And I'm sure there's some I'll never get unless I go back to school for a literary degree.
Yeah. Literary, mythology, chemistry. I Do you think it would be possible for some readers to kind of find it distracting, all the references?
Yeah, and actually, I sort of think he was doing that on purpose. There are a few things in this plot that are going to be obvious to the reader. And so throwing in a razzle-dazzle allusion to Greek mythology may be intended to just throw you off balance. Again, you know, intentional confusion.
Yeah, I mean, this is treading kind of close to spoiler territory, but, you know, it's kind of obvious that all the trouble is not just about this replica of the Star Stone.
Yeah, that's true. And the location of the stone is a mystery that some people will get. I certainly didn't, though it was obvious once they explained it. But there's another mystery driving the plot, which is much deeper and surprised me when it came.
Yeah, yeah. And I did kind of cotton to where the Star Stone was. But I think the other mystery you're talking about is the Boojum.
Yeah, yeah, our snark.
Yes. So, like I said, we're getting kind of close to spoilers. So let's go ahead and just switch over to spoilers. But in case anybody hasn't gotten the message, the book is really, really enjoyable. It's a quick read. I don't know. It's like 180 pages in the library-bound hardcover that I had. And it's a quick read. It has some absolutely delightful turns of phrase. So, spoiler time. The Star Stone. I kind of pictured it like the Life Day orbs from the Star Wars Holiday Special, which I just saw in Vancouver.
Yeah, but now who's doing obscure references?
Right.
Yeah. So the Star Stone replica that everybody is bothering Fred about is, of course, the real one, which one of his academic friends had been tasked with duplicating.
Mm. And of course, you know, as things do, the replica and the real stone get mixed up and end up with Fred via a roommate.
Yeah. I think this much most readers will see. Fred's kind of slow to figure it out, and I like that. As readers, we know we're reading a novel, so we expect something to be unusual. But in real life, you know, a very unlikely thing is not quite easily accepted. You know, I prefer my characters to act realistically in that sense. In the Asimov story that I published last year, I actually gave my main character a grade 2 concussion to excuse him for not figuring out what was going on, because I knew it was going to be obvious to the reader.
Right.
You know, Zelazny does the same thing to Fred more than once, including, like I said, shooting him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can be frustrating when especially if you have a book like, I remember Digital Fortress from Dan Brown. It was supposed to be this smart thriller, and it has all these nuclear scientists and geniuses, and they can't figure out the difference between uranium-238 and 235 is 3. The climactic moment of the book is that, and I'm like, come on, guys. And to be fair to Fred, you know, it probably is kind of hard to think straight where you're being chased or tortured and, you know, there's different human criminals trying to steal the stone, the government and aliens sort of trying to help. So it can be confusing to the reader and, of course, to Fred.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a big distraction. You know, watch this hand, don't watch that one. But there are two invisible layers going on. Spoiler, the strange voice Fred is hearing is the Star Stone itself, which is an artificial intelligence that has been absorbed into Fred's body.
Right. Yeah. That makes it kind of hard to find. I think the first thing he hears is, "Do you hear me dead?
You're right.
Do you see me dead?"
And he hears what it was, several versions. Do you hear me lead?
Yeah.
There's another, even more hidden layer, which is an alien who is trying to sabotage Earth by stealing the stone, which would set the Earth back diplomatically.
Mm-hmm. Diplomatically, because for political reasons, in the Confederation of Intelligent Species, where Earth is now a member, the alien construct inside Fred is trying to warn Fred about this. And then in a climactic scene, Fred finally puts it together and chases the alien up a tower using his acrophilia powers.
It really hangs together once it's resolved, which I think is pretty remarkable, because one of the obscure facts about this book is that Zelazny wrote it in a single draft on a typewriter with no editing. Yeah. And I can tell you, as a struggling writer, I'm absolutely in awe of this.
As a podcast editor, I'm in awe of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. My first attempts at writing happened before word processors.
Mm.
And I wrote and edited on a paper with paper and pencil long over and over again before I would go even near a typewriter. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, with a word processor, I'm endlessly editing. I don't get writer's block anymore. I get stuck in editing loops.
Right.
You know, I cannot even imagine just sitting down and pounding out a novel without a delete key. Mm-hmm. I personally think we should separate literature into what was written before the word processor and what was written after the word processor.
Yeah.
And writers that could go straight to copy, they're mythic giants of old, you know, with a lost kind of underappreciated talent.
Yeah. And I do think the book kind of reads that way, a stream of consciousness kind of, because it's like he's just ad-libbing or spitballing, like that phrase that you read earlier. It sounds like song lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Though sometimes I think he's just, you know, noodling along literary or philosophical things while he just sort of gathers his thoughts and proceeds to the next one.
Yeah, yeah. I also love the bumbling antagonists, Morton Zemeister and Jamie Buckler. It's great names. May as well have called them Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, you know, I totally did not think about that. But are you talking Shakespeare, Gilbert, or Stoppard's play?
I was thinking, I don't even know. Is it Gilbert and Sullivan?
Well, it's actually from Shakespeare, and then Gilbert and Sullivan did it as a play, and then Jamie Buckler did another play, all with those same two characters.
Yeah, no, I was thinking of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Oh, okay. And okay. Yeah, but, you know, it's a classic kind of thing that you can just go spinning off into other thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. So we do need to talk about the Rennius machine.
Yeah, I mentioned that there are a lot of parallels to Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, and a lot of them revolve around the Rennius machine, which is an alien device also involved in the cultural exchange. Mm-hmm. The device inverts things in three dimensions the way a mirror does in two. Mm-hmm. But unlike the mirror in Through the Looking Glass, which inverted logic, the Rennius machine operates at the molecular level. Mm-hmm. Making our left-handed proteins right-handed. And right. So Fred gets reversed in the device, and he gets to enjoy stereo isomers of bourbon and French fries.
Right.
All of which gets very cleverly woven into the plot.
Yeah, it talks about how his tastes change, right? There's like, I can't remember if it was cigarettes that all of a sudden are terrible or like the
it was a milkshake.
It was a milkshake
was undrinkable.
Right, yeah. right. Yeah, that's fun. And with the Rennius machine, right, at some point, I think he puts a penny through it and it just makes Abe face the other direction. And then he puts it through again and it changes it. It switches it in the other direction as well.
Yeah. Well, it goes inside out first and then back. But the inside out proves to be a very effective weapon later.
A gruesome weapon.
Yeah. Rather.
Yeah. So slightly off topic here, do you feel like the book has aged well?
I think it's aged better than most of that period. Mm-hmm. It is, like all science fiction of that time, weak on women characters. Mm. But by not having very many female characters, Zelazny sort of avoids a lot of the cringeworthy sexism you can occasionally find in people like Heinlein or Asimov.
Sure, yeah. I guess sins of omission, is that better than sins of commission?
Yeah, it's still noticeable. Yeah. There was one poem about the female form. It didn't objectify women as much as it formulized them
or
geometricized them. That was an interesting poem.
Yeah, and I mentioned the retro future because there's no internet, there's no cell phones, but there's space flight.
Right. Yeah, if you're a young reader, you know, I guess you're just going to have to suspend disbelief and imagine what life was like for your parents or your grandparents. You know, I spent half my life without cell phones, so this is easier for me. But when I reread it this last time, there was a line where he, quote, cradles it. Mm-hmm. And I puzzled me for a second till I realized that it was a phone. I'd forgotten about phone cradles.
Yeah.
You know, and the most glaring thing I noticed on this reread was the main character's complete disregard for getting permission to do an archaeological dig at an Australian indigenous site.
Yeah, that's a no-no. And he did seem to kind of operate on the I'll get forgiveness rather than permission.
Yeah, as college students are wont to do. Mm-hmm. And my own age showed on this reading. When he was tromping over people's roofs, I was wincing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking, did he scare the people with his inside, with his footsteps? Did he mess up the shingles on their roofs? Mm-hmm. You know, being a homeowner kills part of the fun of this book.
Yeah, yeah. All those punk kids always running around my roof.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of dissonance there too, right? Because he's a, you know, over 30 undergrad, still living the undergrad party and prank lifestyle.
Yeah. And another thing that was common for Zelazny, at least in the first half of his career, his main character smokes a lot.
Yeah.
And having worked in a cancer center, that made me wince more than the lack of a cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they could use the Rhenius machine to turn people inside out to pull the cancer out of their lungs. That actually kind of reminds me of the Big Time. There's a machine where they can turn things inside out in that, the Fritz Leiber book. But so, right. You read this book when it first came out?
Yes.
And I think you mentioned that some folks were disappointed in it.
Yeah, I it's 76, so the space race was pretty much over. Hmm. It's going to be several years before the shuttle flew, and that had been one of the big drivers of science fiction. Mm-hmm. And the what people first called soft science fiction, and later called New Wave, mm-hmm. was supplanting scientist writers like Asimov and Clarke. Writers like Zelazny and Le Guin were the big names of that movement. So some people expected more. Mm-hmm. But if you look back at their bibliographies, you realize that in retrospect, both Zelazny and Le Guin were near the end of their imperial period. Mm-hmm. And I sort of view Doorways in the Sand as Zelazny's last really good novel. I mean, I know some people really like A Night in Lonesome October, but in fact, that was written very shortly after Doorways in the Sand, but wasn't published until near the end of his life when he finally got Gay and Wilson to illustrate it.
Mm. And he wrote his Amber series for quite some time. I think he was still writing it at this time.
He was still writing it then. But, you know, to be perfectly honest, most people view the Amber books as commercial rather than artistic works. I think the joke was said that one of the Amber books paid for his swimming pool. You know, yeah. The more conventional aspects of Doorways in the Sand may, you know, have been perceived by some people as selling out. Mm. You know, he did continue writing more experimental works. I mean, his very next novel, Bridge of Ashes, was way out there. Mm. I mean, Zelazny even said Bridge of Ashes taught him the limits of puzzlement.
Oh, well, given how confused I was about this one, I may pass on that one.
Yeah, me too. In retrospect, I think the problem was that new writers with new ideas and energy were coming up, while older writers, or at least middle-aged writers like Zelazny, they had mortgages to pay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the eternal paradox of in art, right? Where it's, well, you're just doing a rehash of your old favorites. If you stay too safe, right? You stay in similar tones and themes, or, well, this is too different from your other work if you push the boundaries. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. I mean, Doorways in the Sand, like I said, is either Zelazny's last great novel, or it's the beginning of his decline. Hmm. Either way, it's near enough to his peak that I found it just loads of fun. And I still reread it about every 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. I always notice something new. I mentioned how Fred's acrophilia and college lifestyle resonated with me when I read it. But I have one more thing I should mention that was in this book. It was the single most useful thing I ever got from a book, at least for my career.
Okay. All right. Let's hear it.
All right. So when Fred was trying to understand the aliens that were assisting him, he ruminates on a law of large organizations, such as the one that the aliens were clearly part of.
Right.
And that law states that the longer in a large organization exists, the quote, more it grinds out restrictions that hinder its own functions, end quote.
Ladies and gentlemen, government.
Yeah, there you go. But in the end, only those on the very edges of the organization could get anything done, and they always have to violate rules to do it. Mm-hmm. So I read these words just months before starting a career at a large academic and highly bureaucratic medical center. And that law was clearly in operation. I recognized it right away. And I managed to steer my career a little bit, bending the rules when I could, or finding places where the rules hadn't reached yet. And in the end of my career, when the restrictions became unavoidable, I retired early.
I mean, that's, it's a pretty valuable life lesson. You not necessarily thinking that you're going to get that from a paperback science fiction novel. So it makes sense why this book is special to you.
It is. But you know, most of all, it just makes me laugh. And these days, laughter is a very precious commodity.
Yeah, definitely. I wrote down a few quotes. So let me give a couple representative samples. There's one where he's thinking about, he's getting ready to go to bed after quite a bit of drinking. And he says, "Maybe we'll have some fresh ideas in the morning," he said, rising. "Thinking them will be painful, whatever they are," I said, "going over to the couch and kicking off my shoes. Let there be an end to thought. Thus do I refute Descartes. I sprawled, not a cogito or sum to my name." Which, it's like, it's very highly literary. And then, I'm not sure if it's after that. At some point, he wakes up with a hangover. And he says, "Caffeine, nicotine, the games the blood sugars play. I do not know what it was that pierced the dark bubble as I sat there assembling the morning and myself." And then another one, when he believes he's about to be painfully consumed by a gigantic carnivorous-looking plant alien that is just a telepath, I think. Am I thinking of that right? I think I am.
Yes.
And this is one of those ones where it's at the right at the beginning of a chapter, so you don't really know what's happening or how we got into that situation. And it says, "As it paused for an instant, perhaps debating the best disposition of the alkaloids my excess nitrogen would provide, the past couple of days flashed before me. No more than that, as I was still fresh on earlier portions of my life from the last time I had been about to die." So he didn't have to have his whole life flash before his eyes anymore, because he was getting used to it.
He'd already done it several times.
Yeah. Any quotes you want to share or other thoughts about this one?
Well, I would just say that in one way, this book is kind of old school science fiction, because old school science fiction would deliver you a dollop of real science wrapped up in a fun story.
Yeah.
But in Doorways in the Sand, it's not just science, but literature, mythology, and a dozen other disciplines. And I think that makes it definitely worth reading.
Yeah. And things kind of get reconfigured as you go through the book, because you have the portion of the book where he's reversed, which was really interesting. And he's trying to figure out how to go to the correct door on a car. And I think it took him a while to figure out how to drive when all of his perceptions were reversed.
Yeah. I thought that was exceptionally well thought through. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't just kind of mirror. It was just the whole topography was messed up in his head.
And just some of the main character is clever, but you know, there's a limit to clever. He keeps getting himself put into these awful situations. And I loved the fact that the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kept showing up. Just when you think you're shot of them, nope, there they are again. Finally there was a reappearance of the uncle, right?
The uncle finally resolved it. The mostly dead uncle.
Right.
But, you know, there was a well thought out aspect of his character. You know, like you said, he kept missing things and getting in trouble, but when he was doing something specifically, he planned it well ahead and thought it through like it was homework, something that he was very good at after 13 years being an undergrad. So, you know, he was meticulous, but didn't seem to see the big picture quite as well as he might have.
Well, and even like the skill of Zelazny mixing in the antagonism between him and the college dean or whoever it was, who at a critical point in the book announces, "Hey, by the way," I think he reads it in reverse, right? Because that's right after he's been reversed. Right. He's presented with his diploma that says he now has a PhD.
Yeah. Just skip the undergrad, just go straight to the PhD. Mm-hmm. That turned out to be easier than cornering him in some major.
Right. And then that allowed him to get put into a position that was important, I believe.
Yes. And, you know, you talk about aspirational. If you're nearing the end of your college degree, having somebody who gets a job like that, man, you go, "Oh, man, I'd like that job."
So, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I said earlier that this is It's a very easy book to read. I enjoyed looking at the variety of covers for them. I don't know if you can still see my video, but
I can.
It's kind of like a third eye image almost, which I think is
right. I've seen that one. The one I have is the old one, which is him sitting up on a high building and a jewel beneath him. Mm-hmm.
If
I could make my video work, I'd show it to you.
Yeah. Well, send me a photo of it. I'll put a couple of the photos in here just because I really enjoy, you know, kind of classic science fiction book cover art. It's really cool. But yeah, like I said, the version that I have, I think it's 181 pages, something like that. Just, you know, took a few days to read at a pretty leisurely pace. And, you know, I wrote down a bunch of quotes. I restrained myself from showing all of them, because I kept doing it. I kept taking photos of it and then having my phone pull the text out of it so I could throw it into a Google document. But like it was every chapter, there was something that was just an absolutely delightful way of phrasing something.
Yeah, I really enjoy it for that reason. I mean, even the first time I read it, when like you, I had no clue what was going on, I would still stumble across these lines that were just so much fun.
Yeah, yeah. And if we haven't sold it, you know, the like Bob said up top, you know, the book is just about this guy who has no idea why he's being chased. Well, he knows why he's being chased, but doesn't have any idea, you know, like, I would give you the information if I could, and I don't have it. And at some point, you know, you right. might catch on to something that he doesn't know. But it's just it's a fun chase through all that stuff. And I really enjoyed the early reveal of these six-fingered tiny aliens inhabiting the bodies of Australian fauna, right? Like the wombat.
The wombat, yeah. The kangaroo.
Yeah. And a donkey, of course, at some point.
Yeah, donkey. But I loved it when he was trying to when he was dressed as a dog at the end, and he was trying to get him to play frisbee,
right.
And he just said, "And you suck at this, you know." And he said, "Well, if it's any consolation, there was something similar on my planet, and I sucked at it there too."
Yeah, really, really, really interesting book, and you know, I can kind of see, especially given the year that it was set in with 75 for the Nebulas and 76 for the Hugos, you know, losing to the Forever War. The Forever War is the right winner. I think it's the more kind of enduring classic. But this one, I think, you know, it's kind of underrated. I'd never heard of it.
Highly recommended.
But yeah, a good one. I enjoyed it. Thanks for exercising your nerd director powers on Patreon. So if you want to force me to do a book, just, you know, make it a fun one like this one, and join up on the Patreon, and you can do that. So, Bob, any place people can find you or find your work?
Okay, I do have something out now. It'll be out through, I guess, the end of February at Troll Breath, and I'll send you a link to that. And I have a homepage that lists my other works. I'll send you that too, so you can put them in the show notes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, this will go up first of the year, so that'll give people a little early warning. Yeah.
Actually, I'll mention Troll Breath, being an online magazine, they do a thing called Free Fridays, and on I think the 23rd of January, my story Chuck's Gun, which some people might actually see some vague resemblances to this novel. At least I did. I was doing the proofs. While I was preparing for this, while I was reading this, and it'll be free that one day, Friday the 23rd. So,
yeah, cool. Well, Bob, it's great to talk to you again. And I still get people commenting on the Pandemic Fiction podcast, because I think that was one of the highlights of the Zoomed Out series that I did. So thanks for coming back.
Well, thank you. Yep. Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Bob. It's a really, really fun book. I know it was kind of a short discussion. We didn't really talk all that much about the plot, I don't think. But yeah, like it was a fun kind of change of pace, especially when you look back at the Hugo nominees of that time and the Nebula nominees of that time. So as this comes out, I'm actually in the process of scheduling and starting to record episodes for my Foundational Fantasy series. But it'll probably be instructive to actually listen to some of those episodes to figure out what I'm going for, because it's not necessarily going to be the same thing in everyone. I'll try and do a good job in the first episode of describing kind of what I want to do with that series. But yeah, thank you for being a listener in 2025. Now, this one comes out first of 2026, so I'm hoping for another good year in 2026. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Who Goes There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.